The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. The surprise announcement of a U.S. troop pullout from Syria has fair-minded citizens and even Republican members of Congress concerned. Senator Tom Cotton helps us sort this out.
This is not a whole-scale withdrawal of the 1,000-plus troops we have in Syria.
But Middle East expert Michael Rubin is not convinced.
The United States and Turkey have fundamentally different notions of what constitutes a terrorist group.
Last week, we saw the NBA at its worst about something that should stay off the hardwood.
You got Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz agreeing with Elizabeth Warren and Chuck Schumer across the entire political spectrum. Everybody's saying, what in the world is the NBA doing here?
And the U.S. Supreme Court starts the 2019 session, beginning with two cases having huge cultural ramifications.
The employee would want to begin dressing and presenting as a woman at work.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com, and let me invite you to join us now by video. And follow me on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. And follow Town Hall Review, at Town Hall Review. Early last week, the president's announcement of a U.S. pullout from northern Syria raised big questions and received almost entirely negative reaction. It made things in the Middle East even more complex, a region already engulfed in strife. It involves Turkey, a NATO member and a major power in the region. Almost immediately following this news, Turkey began moving troops and artillery into northern Syria, a region oft referred to as Kurdistan. Therein lies the rub. The Turks view the Kurds in that part of the world as terrorists. We have viewed them as allies who helped us push back ISIS. To gain a perspective, I spoke first with Senator Tom Cotton. Everything is obliged to fit in their narrative that the president likes strongmen, including this move in Syria. I don't think he likes Erdogan very much. I certainly don't. Now I'd like your opinion on this, because I have been defending this as the necessary realignment of our forces as we face another set of continuing resolutions that's going to bleed the Department of Defense of necessary resources and planning money, and the president's dealing with reality. NATO won't help. No one will take the ISIS prisoners. He's calling the bluff on the world. What do you think of this, Senator Cotton?
So, Hugh, I think there was some confusion yesterday in all quarters about exactly what was happening, and that partly to rest on the administration for not clarifying and explaining exactly what happened. I think by last night it became clearer to many people. This is not a whole-scale withdrawal of the 1,000-plus troops we have in Syria. We only have a few dozen troops in the area that are under discussion in northern Syria. Erdogan has said for several weeks that he intends to make some kind of incursion to protect his security interests against what he views as a domestic terror organization in his own country. President Trump apparently made very clear to Erdogan on Sunday that the United States, contrary to Erdogan's request, was not going to support that operation, but also was not going to keep those few dozen troops in harm's way. He's also made very clear publicly there'll be severe consequences if the Turkish military incursion, should it come to pass, leads to wide-scale violence against our allies, the Syrian Democratic Forces. But the president has not said that he's going to withdraw all our troops from Syria. In particular, remember, from our standpoint, from our long-term security interests, from the interest of our partners like Israel, the troops we have in southern Syria, not northern Syria, but southern Syria, are more important because that is the land bridge between Iran and Lebanon. But as you say, Hugh, we've got to remember also that our gravest long-term threat is not inside of Syria. It's not even in the Middle East. It's China.
Michael Rubin, resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, is hard to top on matters Middle East. He speaks the language, knows the leadership, travels there frequently. Importantly, he often helps sort through the complexities of this region. This time, Michael was cautious about the president's move. Now Turkey is threatening to move, I guess, east of the Euphrates. David Ignatius had tweets last night saying it's imminent. First of all, what do you understand to be the situation on the ground before we talk about what that means?
The situation is it remains imminent. We've withdrawn perhaps a few dozen or pulled back a few dozen forces which were in coordination with the Turks. That said, the other issue which has changed too is that we are no longer coordinating with the Turks on the airspace. However, we haven't stopped controlling the airspace. So this has complicated Turkish plans because they assume that they would have a green light when it came to the control of the airspace, and they do not. But when it comes to facts on the ground, the question is, if the facts on the ground have changed completely, whether economically punishing Turkey would change those issues which are of most concern, for example, to American national security, the continued detention of the Islamic State prisoners, as well as the simple fact that when Turkey has controlled that border in the past, we've had it become basically a way station for the Islamic State.
That is true. Now, you write in your piece, the Kurdish-administered regions of Syria are the most secure and tolerant within the country. Erdogan's desire to conquer them has far less to do with supposed terrorism and more to do with his desire to expand Turkey's borders, eradicate the precedent of any Kurdish self-government, not subordinate to Turkish dictates, and to grab local oil wells. And then you note the Turkish move on Cyprus 45 years ago and suggest this is the same sort of situation. If, in fact, they're grabbing turf and oil, are they going to be likely in the business of letting ISIS run rampant with the black flags again?
Ultimately, that is one possibility. But the broader problem, Hugh, is that the United States and Turkey have fundamentally different notions of what constitutes a terrorist group. Let's put the Kurds aside for a moment. One of the greatest concerns to American forces and American strategists, this is why people like Defense Secretary Mattis resigned, is that many of the Turkish proxy groups have incorporated former fighters from the Islamic State or would match what the United States believes to be al-Qaeda.
But you're saying because of this realignment, we have to worry about the rebirth of ISIS?
Absolutely, we do. The United States has plugged the vacuum. We have plugged the vacuum with the Syrian Democratic Forces, which are predominantly Kurdish. But when it comes to the Turkish-backed Free Syrian Army, some members of that Free Syrian Army, especially the former members of Jabhat al-Nusra, which has gone through several name changes, are affiliates with al-Qaeda. That is one of the concerns. Turkey, of course, would say that the Syrian Democratic Forces are predominantly affiliated with the Kurdistan Workers Party, the so-called PKK, which has waged an insurgency inside Turkey for more than 40 years. And so that is where Turkey is coming from. I've traveled back and forth to northeast Syria, and while there is still some affiliation with the PKK, when you look at any database of attacks and so forth, Turkey would be very hard-pressed to suggest that many, if any, attacks had come from the areas of Syria in which they are now talking about entering.
At the same time our country was puzzling over Turkey and the Kurds, a shameful domestic drama hit. It came from within the National Basketball Association, the NBA, considered one of the more woke and left-leaning sports enterprises. Here's my Salem colleague, Sebastian Gorka, with Fox Sports Radio morning host, Clay Travis.
Why is the NBA promoting communism now?
Well, one of the argument would be that some of their political leanings are so far left-wing that they may be communist, so they're just being consistent with their values. But
so explain this story to us. So there's this tweet from a manager, and then there's a response. For those of out there who aren't big followers of sports, given the breakdown of what happened and why it's so crazy, Clay.
So, yeah, the GM, general manager of the Houston Rockets, which are actually the most popular team in China because Yao Ming, who's the most famous Chinese basketball player ever, played for the Rockets for several years. He is the GM, Daryl Morey is, and they are on what's supposed to be basically a goodwill-like ambassador tour of Asia, spreading the gospel of basketball. And while he was in Japan, he had not yet gone to China. I don't know if he still will go to China at all. That GM said that that he supported the Hong Kong protesters in their quest for democracy. Well, from there, China loses its mind. The NBA has no idea how they should be responding. And the end result is that the NBA has been kowtowing, bending the knee, if you're a fan of Game of Thrones, to the leadership of China over this tweet, which is so controversial that it just endorsed democracy, which is something that I think in general most people in America agree with. The NBA has been so ham-handed in this response that they politicians, in an era when nobody agrees on anything, you've got Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz, Democrats in the Senate, agreeing with Elizabeth Warren and Chuck Schumer, sorry, Republicans in the Senate, agreeing with Democrats in the Senate. Across the entire political spectrum, everybody's saying, what in the world is the NBA doing here?
Look, after the insanity of the Kaepernick and the massive drop in audiences and viewership, how can you explain to us, you're in this, you live this every day, you're on Fox Sports Radio, how is the NBA out of touch with America this badly?
Well, it's a good point. And I think what has really sort of hoisted the NBA on its own petard, so to speak, is that the NBA has been uber woke in the American marketplace. They pulled their All-Star game out of Charlotte, North Carolina, over a debate surrounding a transgender public bathroom access in North Carolina. Right. They abandoned and banned the word owner from NBA parlance because they said it had connotations of slavery and was racially insensitive. Those are such far left-wing opinions for a sports league to have that many people are asking the question, and certainly it's the one that I've been asking, why are all of these coaches like Steve Kerr and Greg Popovich and players like LeBron James and certainly a commissioner like Adam Silver so quick to embrace woke political mantra when it comes to things like banning the word owner and pulling out of the state of North Carolina for an All-Star game, and yet not simultaneously able to say, you know what, we believe in democracy and defending the First Amendment rights of one of our top executives in this league. So it's not just that the NBA has been poor in the way they've responded to this issue. They also have done an awful job of at least being consistent and addressing political-related issues. If you're going to speak out politically, one would think that one of the things that you would most speak out for politically would be defending the rights of people around the world to live in democracy.
For my complete interviews with Senator Cotton and Dr. Rubin, visit townhallreview.com.
The dress code prohibits tattoos and ensures they're wearing dark clothes, no flashy jewelry or hair, and is sex-specific. In 2007, a biological man was hired as the funeral director, being the front face to be working with the grieving families and greeting guests, and he agreed to abide by that dress code. But 6 years later, told Tom Ross, the funeral home's owner, that the employee would want to begin dressing and presenting as a woman at work.
Abortion and the definition of sex go before the reconstituted U.S. Supreme Court. Stay with us. Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. This past week, the Supreme Court began its 2019 session and was greeted with demonstrations concerning two critically and potentially landmark cases. One has to do with the definition of sex within the five protected classes under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act. Passed into law in 1964, the question is, was Congress referring to biological sex equality when it prohibited sexual discrimination based on sex? I spoke with Kristen Wagoner, Senior Counsel for the Alliance Defending Freedom, ADF, which is representing the defendant. Tell us about the case.
Well, it's a family-owned funeral home. They've been serving grieving families in the Detroit area for about 100 years. They have a professional dress code that they've abided by to ensure that their employees are essentially blending into the background and that they're focusing on families that are in the greatest time of need. The dress code prohibits tattoos and ensures they're wearing dark clothes, no flashy jewelry or hair, and is sex specific. In 2007, a biological man was hired as the funeral director, being the front face to be working with the grieving families and greeting guests, and he agreed to abide by that dress code. But 6 years later, told Tom Ross, the funeral home's owner, that the employee would want to begin dressing and presenting as a woman at work. Tom Ross considered the different competing interests that he had of his other employees, of Stevens, the employee, and the grieving families, and determined that that wasn't going to work. The EEOC then decided to make this a test case to try to change the definition of sex discrimination under federal law to include transgender status. And now we're at the Supreme Court.
Title VII was passed in 1964. There is simply no way that the Congress of 1964 intended its protections to apply to transvestites, transgendered status, LGBTQ issues of any sort. Not a prayer that they did so. So you're not only fighting for the funeral home, you're fighting for the court's approach to statutes. Are you not, Kristen?
That is the heart of this case. The case law has said what you look at is what would the public have understood the law to mean, the term sex to mean, at the time the statute was enacted. It's not what Congress had in its mind, and it's not how someone might understand it today. It's in 1964, what did sex mean to the public?
I don't know how you lose other than an ideologically driven justice, but I want people to understand, since I've been appealing for funds for Alliance Defending Freedom all month, how long has this case been going on and what does it cost?
Oh, it's gone on for many years. Now the EEOC has sided under us and the United States is coming in on our side. But Hugh, I think something else, it takes a lot of effort, a lot of money to put these cases forward. The other thing I think is important to bring out is sex discrimination also requires not only that you are taking into account whether someone is biologically male or female, but you also need to prove that one sex is treated worse than the other. And you certainly don't have that here, as all men and women are required to abide by the dress code.
If it goes the other way, if this case is lost, if Alliance Defending Freedom had not brought it, one could see every sort of 1964 Act application of the ban on discrimination between men and women applied across the board across the United States.
If you think about Title IX and the equal opportunity for women that it's supposed to provide, we're literally working with clients in Connecticut where high school girls have lost out because two boys are competing against them and they've been displaced from 15 state championships in just a couple years. And there are implications to healthcare providers and certainly, as you know, the pronoun issue, compelled speech. It goes on and on.
Another case. G versus June Medical Services concerns a state of Louisiana law requiring abortionists to have admitting services at a nearby hospital. My Salem colleagues Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson, morning hosts on 560 The Answer in Chicago, recently spoke with Margo Cleveland about the case. Margo is a member of the faculty at Notre Dame and a senior contributor to The Federalist.
With respect to the court's court's review of this Louisiana law, they granted cert to review this Louisiana pro-life law and what that might mean for some of the recent pro-life laws that have been enacted in Louisiana and Michigan and Georgia.
So the Louisiana case actually has an interesting twist to it that I don't think a lot of people noticed when the Supreme Court said that they were going to hear it. The Louisiana law requires that abortionists that operate in the state have to have admitting privileges for a nearby hospital. And that was what everyone was focusing on. And they were pointing out that a few years prior, a Texas law that was similar was struck down. And now we have new composition. We have Justice Gorsuch. We have Justice Kavanaugh. And that was what the focus was, which is, you know, interesting. We want to see what the new composition of the Supreme Court is going to do. But the Louisiana law is actually very different than Texas in the application because the state of Texas is very different than Louisiana. But the other part here is that the Supreme Court also granted the state of Louisiana's cross appeal or cross petition, I should say. And what the state said is, hey, if you're going to take this issue and you're going to take this case, you also should consider whether or not these plaintiffs actually even have the right to challenge the law, because all of the plaintiffs were either abortion providers, so the doctors, or the clinics. And Louisiana's cross petition made a really strong argument saying this is not who should be challenging this law, because these are health and safety provisions. And this is the state trying to protect women from these doctors. And if you read the cross petition, it makes the point really clear when it's pointing out that these abortion clinics have had violations in the past, and that some of these doctors are ones that we obviously want to be protecting women against, such as one of the doctors who has absolutely no medical training from either school, medical school, or residency in abortions.
This is against the backdrop, too, not just of the examples you gave, but against the backdrop of perhaps more high-profile cases, Gosnell, and that's still being in the public's mind because of the movie, but also the case here in Illinois, a suburban-based abortionist, Klopfer, who was operating clinics in Indiana that were ultimately shut down and his license revoked before he passed on and the gruesome discoveries at his home were found.
Absolutely. And that was what really struck me as I was reading the cross petition, that Klopfer was shut down and he lost his license. But before that happened, he actually was forced to shut down his Fort Wayne facility because the city, or I should say the county that Fort Wayne is in, passed an ordinance saying that if you are basically a traveling doctor, and they said you have to have another doctor who will serve as a backup. And another doctor said, okay, look, I'll be a backup. He's messed up. I've had to treat people in the ER because he's left, you know, fetuses, parts of fetuses inside the women, and they've had complications. I'll step up. But then after it came out that Klopfer had performed an abortion on a young girl who was a rape victim, didn't report it as required by state law, he said, hey, I'm not doing this anymore. And that's actually what shut down Klopfer's Fort Wayne clinic. It was laws like what Texas has that actually shut him down and stopped him from performing abortions in Fort Wayne much sooner than anything else.
Catch the complete interviews with Wagoner and Cleveland at townhallreview.com. Coming up.
It's all to appease an enraged liberal activist base.
An outspoken member speaks to hostage takers in the Do-Nothing Congress. When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Hey, thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Our podcast is sponsored by Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose liberty is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-691-8969. That's 800-691-8969. Or visit townhallreview.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Congressman Lee Zeldin from New York's 1st Congressional District sits on the Oversight and Investigation Subcommittee, and he's had it. A former Army captain during the Iraq War, Zeldin has no patience for what he sees in the House that is blocking bills to assist his constituency and the entire country. Recently, he stood up and he did what he'd been trained to do, fight. Fight when he sees a mob of sorts holding us hostage. My Salem colleague Sebastian Gorka applauded this performance and brought Zeldin on America First to congratulate him.
Why are you one of the few people angry on Capitol Hill at what you described as this nation being taken hostage, Lee?
On the process and on the substance, this impeachment sideshow is a clown show, is one that should have started if they want to have an impeachment inquiry. I don't believe that they should, but if they do, there should have been a vote by the full House. It shouldn't be started by a press statement from the Speaker of the House. The minority party should have subpoena rights. The president should be able to have counsel present at these depositions to be able to ask questions, present evidence, to be able to, you know, cross-examine these witnesses. And instead, on the substance, the selective releasing of some cherry-picked information while not actually providing the media and the American public the other 99% of the story from these depositions, it's a kangaroo court. So for the president to make the decision that this process is so rigged, it's so screwed up and not right. And basically challenging Speaker Pelosi and Adam Schiff, that if you want to go down these rabbit holes, you're going to have to start following some kind of rules. There has to be some type of formal process, some type of due process, because we're wasting all of this time on this impeachment fairy tale instead of everything else that my constituents want me down here fighting for to deliver for them and the American public around the country. They see Congress chasing these rabbit holes that Adam Schiff, who's lying on one thing after another, is taking us all down.
Explain this word. You used very powerful language today. It was clear that you were passionate. You used the phrase hostage, taken hostage. Describe exactly what that means, what the Democrat Party that have been elected to represent their constituents. And you even mentioned this MCUA, this new trade deal with Mexico and Canada. Why did you bring that up in that soundbite, Congressman Zeldin?
The USMCA is something that would be increasing U.S. jobs, growing GDP, increasing investment in the United States, ending NAFTA with a better trade deal for the United States, and held hostage because you have a few freshman members and some of their friends who have launched primary campaigns against senior members of Democratic leadership, committee chairs. I actually think it's going to get more dysfunctional as the weeks and months go along if these members are able to continue to roll the speaker the way that they do, so that our focus is now in total gridlock. You see leadership eagerly ripping the country in half to appease these few members, to appease an enraged liberal activist base that, since the president got elected, they've all been insisting on how you have to impeach the president. So here we are. They don't know what their charges are. They don't know what their facts will be to support whatever evidence they haven't yet found or produced. And we're all supposed to go along with that. And you know, when you talk about, let's say there's one estimate for USMCA, there would be 176,000 new jobs. For me, I'm thinking of 176,000 Americans who are able to have a better path towards achieving the American dream, to be able to take care of themselves, their families, to be able to own a home and enjoy life. And they are being deprived of that opportunity. It's just one particular piece of legislation. It's important. But there are so many different examples that would improve lives here in America. This isn't improving lives in America. It's a total gridlock to shut down that progress.
Look, you have demonstrated, Congressman Zeldin, that you're one of the fighters. You're a believer in this nation and the interests of your district, the first district in New York. We know you're going to keep fighting for the next 392 days until the next election. What is your message, not only to your constituents, but to all other Americans who are likewise, along with you, angry that the Democrats have basically forsworn their allegiance to represent their districts and to get things done and to work with this president? What should the average American do if they're angry as well with regards to this hostage taking on Capitol Hill?
We cannot be complacent. Losing is not an option. If you have any listeners out there who live in these districts where you have House Democrats, there's over 30 of them in districts that Donald Trump won, you have an opportunity to speak up, to talk to your representative, to let them know that this is unacceptable.
Coming up, the madness of crowds.
We have become incapable of having honest conversations in our society because anyone who dares to do it has the mob come right at them.
Author Douglas Murray, when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Douglas Murray is a distinguished British author, journalist, and social critic. The social critic part of Murray grows louder with each book he writes. His most recent, The Madness of Crowds, hits hard. Do you sometimes feel like things you are expected to applaud, even cheer, certain societal movements are just plain nonsense. Murray believes increasing numbers of us have those feelings but are afraid to speak up. But we must, or else. He was a guest of Dan Proft on AM 560 The Answer in Chicago.
Thomas Sowell is famous for observing many things, including that the least intelligent form of life is a committee. In your new book, I'm taking it that perhaps you're suggesting that the most deranged form of life is a crowd.
Oh, yes, and I think there's little doubt about that. The problem with crowds, among much else, is that they stampede and they take out errant opinions which can often turn out to be true. And my contention is that on a whole range of issues, including sex, gender, sexual orientation, race, relations between the sexes, and much, much more, we have become incapable of having honest conversations in our society because anyone who dares to do it has the mob come right at them.
Yeah, and you break up the book into four chapters, gay, women, race, and trans. Speak to trans, the transgender rights movement, and how do you see that connected to some of the other socio-political movements of recent times, a marriage redefinition, some of the advocacy for entitlements based on race? Do you see a connection between all of these movements sort of one after the other, in at least in terms of pronouncement?
I do, because I've noticed in recent years, as I'm sure many of your listeners have, that all of these issues, gay, race, women, trans, have become weaponized, as well as being the basis of almost every day's news. Somebody has said the wrong thing or done the wrong thing, thought the wrong thing. And quite often, that's something that everyone thought until yesterday, but everyone now has to pretend that they've changed their mind on. And the most striking example of this is trans. It's the latest tripwire issue. It's a minority of a minority issue, but it's very telling and very interesting in itself. And the reason why I finish with a chapter on trans is we have not been able to think through publicly what this actually is. And I'm very interested in it. I do, I think, a very humane, careful analysis of what the plausible things and claims within this are, and what the things are that are totally implausible and cannot be acquiesced to. And the striking thing to me is that the radical left in particular, the people who advocate these crazy claims about intersectionality and so on, things that are spilled out from the American liberal academy, claim that all of the issues I write about in this book intersect, that they are, or that we live in a patriarchal, white supremacist society, and that all minorities, which they include women in, who of course not a minority, but that all minorities intersect with their claims, and that to unlock one claim is to unlock them all. And I show, among other things, in The Madness of Crowds, that this is a deranging claim because it is demonstrably false. Because, just to give one very quick example, the claims that the trans movement make run completely against the claims of women's rights. And you cannot, for instance, agree, as we are being asked to believe, that trans is a hardware, born this way issue, but that being a woman is a matter of choice. You know, you can run one of those programs, but not both. And one of the reasons why our public discussion on these things is so febrile at the moment is because we are being asked to simultaneously believe things that cannot both be true. But my claim, among others, on the trans issue is it's not phobic to be asking questions and to be skeptical when, for instance, people are claiming that we should be giving drugs to children and then experimenting on them medically. You know, it doesn't seem obvious to me that this is something we should just wave past in a sort of, you know, this is the latest civil rights struggle and this is just the latest one, and that if you raise an eyebrow or ask a question about this now, that history will deem you to be as bigoted as, you know, I know, Jim Crow or something. I don't agree with this, and I think that the bullying manner in our society of shutting down discussion is meaning that we're going to be doing things in this generation which our successors will look at and think, what were they thinking?
And it seems to me that it's one of the insights that the cultural Marxists, as I would describe them, have, is to use sort of the soft celebration of the identity politics as a way to crowd out dissent. So, for example, this week, Mattel releases gender-neutral Barbies in an effort to be more inclusive. You've got children in drag shows because we want to, and boy, you, and hey, you can't attack children. Hey, stop attacking children if you disagree with the drag shows. Hey, you're attacking children. So you can't argue with it. And thus, what they're actually doing is saying that tolerance is not enough. Acceptance is not enough. Celebration is mandatory, and tolerance, acceptance, and celebration become synonymous in the world.
Yes, and that it's good for you. But this is one of the things I go into, because on each of these issues, people have recognized that basically it's covered in landmines. You know, it's just not worth going there. We see people's careers completely destroyed by thinking publicly about things that everybody else is thinking about. And, you know, I know from my own experience and my readers and people I speak to all around the world about these issues, what I know is that people have a conversation in private, often slightly fearfully, with their loved ones, which they wouldn't dare to have out in the public square. And my belief is that that's extremely unhealthy for society. It's unhealthy to pretend that we know things that we don't know, things like trans, and it's also unhealthy to pretend that we don't know things everyone knew till yesterday, like the relations between sexes. And so my self-appointed task as one of the people in our society that doesn't have to just say what everyone tells me to and isn't subject to a wobbly hierarchy. I mean, I think the striking thing about a lot of this is that corporate and the business world is all sucking in this stuff wholesale. You know, I think it's incumbent upon those of us who are not answerable in that way to say out loud some of the things people are saying and to ask the questions which our society should be asking.
To hear the complete conversation with Douglas Murray, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up.
Well, what's the deal of Hunter Biden getting $50,000 a month? And I said, well, we think maybe he was buying influence, maybe because he was a vice president. He says, well, that's a bribe, right?
A scandal covered up by impeachment noise in the final segment of Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, a monumental religious liberty case goes before the Supreme Court.
It's also an issue of the rule of law when the wrong governmental body or branch decides to become an activist and change the law rather than Congress.
Another case could challenge Roe v. Wade.
These laws are designed to protect the woman.
The Ukraine whistleblower's motives come into question.
I think it undermines the credibility of this impeachment effort because it's based on this whistleblowing complaint, and I think the wheels are coming off.
And transparency has been tossed out the window.
This whole thing is a fairy tale. Adam Schiff is misleading you, and you're playing along with it.
To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Fred Flights is a longtime member of the Intelligence Committee, more recently a staff member of the House Intelligence Committee. He now serves as the CEO at the Center for Security Policy. Recently, Fred had a lively exchange on CNN's Chris Cuomo show. My colleague Mike Gallagher heard it, then invited Fred onto his program to give him a bit of encouragement.
First of all, kudos. You held your own with Chris Cuomo. I want to play this. This is what you said before it was revealed that Adam Schiff actually did have advanced knowledge of the leakers' report. Let's listen together.
I've seen a number of whistleblowing complaints from intelligence officers in my time with the CIA and the House Intelligence Committee. When I saw this one, I thought it was very unusual, not just that it was extremely well written, but it had legal references and legal footnotes. That was a little bit unusual. But I compared that with the fact that Adam Schiff was talking about the subject matter of this complaint throughout the month of August. He posted a tweet at the end of August, almost identically reflected this complaint. Now, I know from my time on the House Intelligence Committee, whistleblowers frequently come directly to the committee. They're not supposed to, but it happens all the time. So I put this out on Twitter. The day that I did, a senior staffer with the House Intelligence Committee, a Republican, told me, we think you're exactly right, and this was a group project, and my colleagues were involved. And also, that evening, a senior member of the House Intelligence Committee, also a Republican, said, we think you're right on target, and we want to ask this whistleblower under oath, how did you put this together? Who did you work on with it? And did you work on this with the House Intelligence Committee Democrat lawyers?
All right, but just to be clear, at this point, you don't know any of that. You're raising it as questions, but as a guy who worked in the intelligence business, you know that that is meaningless until you can put some meat on the bones. Of course, the Republicans are agreeing with you. That's the whole state of play right now. Anything you say that's negative about this guy or this woman, they're going to pick up on.
Oh, you can say that, Chris, but I'm an analyst. Analysts draw conclusions. I looked at the evidence.
What's the proof?
I looked at my
legalese in the writing? The Schiff tweet doesn't echo the case.
I said it wasn't just a legalese. It was my experience.
By the way, he did invite you on his show to give your analysis, did he not?
No, he invited me on. And look, I didn't want to just defend my position. I wanted to see Cuomo defend his position. And I drew some conclusions based on my experience. I'm within my rights to do that. Whenever a conservative does that, we're not necessarily engaging in politics. We're putting forward our honest point of view.
But honestly, Fred, the more and more truth that is revealed about this whole chapter, the more I think the president and Republicans garner support. What do you make of the approach they're now taking in the mainstream media that Trump isn't allowed to question Joe or his son Hunter Biden's activities because Joe Biden is a presidential candidate in 2020?
I met with a foreign official recently who wanted to know what's going on in Washington. And he said, well, what's this deal of Hunter Biden getting $50,000 a month? This guy's an Israeli businessman. Mm-hmm. I said, well, we think maybe he was buying influence, maybe because he was a vice president. He says, well, that's a bribe, right?
Thanks for joining this edition of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on our earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com. And sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richards, David Posian, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, Ben Brigman, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Thank you for joining us.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, deliver the truth, whatever the cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.